The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and happy Sabbath to you all. Let's open up to Ezekiel in chapter 28. Magicians are amazing performers, and I find it very entertaining to watch somebody do what seems to be impossible. Acts that look as though they go against the forces of nature and human logic are simply amazing to witness. And how many of you have actually been to a live magic show? I, too, have seen some incredible things. In Old Town Hollywood in Southern California, where I used to live in Ventura County, actually, but we would frequent the Hollywood area to various events. There's a mansion there that was built in 1909 by Roland Lane, who owned much of what we know as Hollywood today. It's a beautiful, a magnificent home, and in the early 1960s, this home was converted into a club for magicians, and it was named the Magic Castle. Professional, renowned magicians from all over the world are members of this exclusive club, and as a part of their membership, they are required to perform at the castle a certain number of days each year. And so the club has nightly dinners, four-star menu, and after these meals, there are extraordinary shows where talents perform in various rooms of the mansion, and only members and their guests are allowed into the club. Now, my wife and I happened to be invited to this club on two separate occasions, and it was truly amazing to see close up the sleight of hand and illusions that magicians present. Why, Michelle was even a participant in one of these acts that was performed. But as people sit back and watch such trickery, you can't help but be perplexed as to how they pull such stunts off. It looks as if they are defying all logic, and your brain kind of tweaks a little bit as you simply can't figure out how these tricks are done. Today, magicians have pushed the envelope, and I've even seen some make the Statue of Liberty disappear. An illusion, of course. I've seen such things as levitation. People putting their hands and other items right through a glass window without breaking it. Tricks that are sometimes described as freaky, and it almost seems that some of these magicians must be aligned with an evil spirit in order to do such things. But rest assured, it's all a hoax. Their feats are what is known as an illusion. And these artists have brilliantly figured out how to deceive the audience into believing that they have, in fact, achieved the impossible. Now, the greatest illusionist of all time is, of course, Satan the devil. He has pulled off what may seem like the impossible, and that he has convinced the general population of mankind that good is evil and evil is good. Today, I would like to give the first part of a two-part message in which we will unmask some of his tricks and reveal the smoke and mirrors, and it will give us insight as to the wiles of the devil. Now, in these two messages, we're going to see some of the significant illusions he has used to deceive America and how he has sold us oppression disguised as joy and sin made out to be an acceptable and even admirable behavior. And we will see how he has done this with clever marketing. In Ezekiel in chapter 28, and beginning in verse 15, regarding Satan, the prophet records, "Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day thou wast created, till iniquity was found in you. By the multitude of thy merchandise they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. And therefore I will cast you as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy thee, O coveting cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire." And so we see, by the multitude of his merchandise, It filled him with violence. And this word, merchandise, is rekula in the Hebrew, and it refers to a trade or practice, such as a merchant who peddles or traffics merchandise. And so the title of Satan's profession of choice is very telling. He is likened to a merchant who traffics merchandise. He actually sells us sin and makes us believe that it is righteous behavior. Not necessarily holy, but to the point where people think they are doing what is right. Evil is made out to be good. And Satan is extremely convincing. Iniquity has been carefully packaged and marketed as enlightened, liberating, and even spiritually advanced. Now, the actual acts of his deception go back to the very beginning of mankind, when he tricked Eve into believing that she was doing the right thing by choosing to eat of the forbidden fruit. But today, his cons have become much more elaborate, but they are still the same time-worn beguiling that he has perpetrated on man since the very beginning. In our modern society, Americans are more morally confused than in any previous generation, and we have been taken by some of the most brilliant marketing schemes in history. Now, although these plots of deceit have been inspired by Satan himself, man is not guiltless. In our arrogance and in our quest for pleasure, we have not only been participants in these heinous plans, but in fact, we have been key players to promoting sick, twisted, and indeed wicked ideals. And so I'm going to go through some of the most significant examples, and there are many, but I'm going to take a few of them in particular because I believe that although we as Christians may look at the practices and ideals of society as mostly wrong, I think many of us have become sympathetic to a degree towards deviancy. And so the first marketing plan of that which is evil that I would like to examine is homosexuality. Now, it was the Apostle Paul who wrote in 1 Corinthians in chapter 6 to be not deceived, neither be fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers. And then he says, nor effeminate, nor abusers of yourselves with mankind. And so this is a direct reference to God's decree in Leviticus stating that homosexuality is an abomination. Thus, it was viewed as such in this country for nearly 200 years. What happened? Something changed. Something convinced the public to view homosexuals not as moral deviants, but instead as freedom fighters, heroes against oppression. How did such a drastic transformation of that which was clearly once seen as wrong and evil take place? Today, most people believe that the gay rights movement began as an oppressed minority that simply wanted to be free. And this is, in fact, what homosexuals want us to believe. They have, in fact, led most Americans to think that they are victims and are instead cultural heroes. Now, this first began when they labeled themselves as gay. This was a marketing tool. Now, think about it. Look in any dictionary. What does gay mean? It means to be happy or joyous. And so why would anyone call their people happy if they were not trying to change how others viewed them? You know, we're just happy and joyful abusers of ourselves, right? Wrong. But if you say one thing against homosexuals, they become enraged and they will attack. They're not so gay anymore, are they? Next, they coined the term gay rights. Now, this is something that the land of the free would surely embrace. I mean, America has long been a nation of freedom fighters who wouldn't want an oppressed people to have their rights. By this, they made themselves out to be tyrannized, when in fact they already had the same rights as every other United States citizen. The only thing they did not have was a favorable opinion in the eyes of the greater public. And so they incorporated the rainbow. After all, everybody likes rainbows, right? They are beautiful. They're colorful. They're amazing displays of creation. And by this, they link themselves to something that is appealing, beautiful, natural. Something God had made became a symbol for their depravity. You think that Satan did not have a hand in that one? The greater onslaught of this homosexual marketing blitz was devised and then shortly thereafter implemented in February of 1988 at a conference of 175 activists. After this meeting, Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen put into book form a public relations plan for their attack, and they titled it After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 90s. Now, these were very smart gentlemen, if you can call them that. They were educated in neuropsychiatry, and they designed aptitude tests for adults with 200-plus IQs. And in their book, they state this: as cynical as it may seem, AIDS gives us a chance to establish ourselves as a victimized minority, legitimately deserving of America's special protection and care. The bottom line, they explain, is this: unabashed propaganda firmly grounded in long-established principles of psychology and advertising. And so this book quickly became the Bible of the homosexual acceptance movement. And its goal, as marketing expert Paul Roundell says, force acceptance of homosexual culture into the mainstream, to silence the opposition, and ultimately to convert American society. And as we can see today, they have been very successful in their endeavor. Homosexuality is widely accepted as legitimate and good in the workplace, in schools, in government, and even in many churches. Today we have homosexual students, teachers, judges, governors, congressmen, and even ministers. Why, even most citizens who are not homosexual have become tolerant, accepting, and even advocate this deviancy. How this was implemented could be talked about for hours, but I'm going to hit a few of the highlights because I believe that some of God's people may have been influenced and allowed themselves to become slightly sympathetic to their cause. Let's turn over to Matthew in chapter 7. The first step in their plan was to look as normal as possible. After all, how could anyone sell straight America on leather fetishes, cross-dressers, transgenders, and the like? The answer? Don't. As the authors of this marketing manual write, when you're very different and people hate you for it, this is what you do. First, you get your foot in the door by being as similar as possible. Then, and only then, when your one little difference is accepted, can you start dragging in other peculiarities, one by one. As the saying goes, allow the camel's nose beneath your tent, and his whole body will soon follow. And as we can see, it has followed. Mardi Gras, gay pride parades, these events resemble pornographic freak shows that march down public streets as if they were some kind of glorious carnival. Now, I don't know if you've seen any of these pictures, but it is a disgusting sight. It's thoroughly depraved as homosexuals make themselves up in every imaginable sick and twisted fetish they can dream up, and they prance around like peacocks in full bloom. And if you dare to say a word against any of it, you are labeled as an oppressive bigot who hates freedom. Now, Christ told us something that, although not directly addresses this situation, his words have an enduring moral principle that does apply. In Matthew 7, and in verse 15, he states, "Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. You shall know them by their fruits." Now, I understand that Christ's comment was about the ministry, but he states a principle that applies to many other situations. In regards to our discussion, the homosexuals, for the most part, initially made themselves out to be normal, upright, clean-cut citizens. They were falsely portrayed as tame sheep who were decent people, but inwardly they were seeking to destroy American values like ravening wolves. This is evident by their fruits. Next, they employed a tactic likened to brainwashing, which they called desensitization, jamming, and conversion. Rundau describes this as psychological terrorism meant to silence expression and support for dissenting opinion. And basically what this means is that they would attack anyone with views in opposition to anything but total support to homosexuality by associating dissenters with bigots, Ku Klux Klan members, murderers, and even Nazis. Now, they did this in a number of ways. One was by taking criminal acts that were committed against gays and making them out to be inspired by hatred and the ideals of conservative Christians. Now, the media ran with these falsified stories, and it soon became frowned upon to have any kind of dislike for homosexuality because you were then associated with white supremacists and criminals. After the Ball lists some of the negative images with which opponents should be associated with, and they write, Klansmen, hysterical backwoods preachers, menacing punks, thugs, and convicts. And to top it off, they mischievously linked Judeo-Christian values to the Nazi Holocaust. Kirk and Madsen write, Religious right will bitterly resent the implied connection between homo-hatred and Nazi fascism, but since they can't defend the latter, they'll end up having to distance themselves by insisting they would never go to such extremes. Such declarations of civility towards gays set our worst detractors on the slippery slope toward recognition of fundamental gay rights. This false link to Nazi fascism they implanted successfully, despite the fact that the widely regarded definitive book on Nazi Germany, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, states that many of the early Nazis were homosexuals. Next came the part of conversion. As Kirk and Madsen put it, conversion of the average American's emotions, mind, and will through a planned psychological attack in the form of propaganda fed to the nation via the media. Now, this was completed by creating situations in movies, on the news, in magazines, and in sitcoms where normal, good-looking people that were well-liked by society were portrayed in appealing atmospheres and in pleasant situations associating with homosexuals. Now, this would cause people to believe that there were some gays who were all right, and by this, they would attach their tolerant feelings to all gays. In addition, those who did not like gays were marketed as bigots who were rejected by their peers in the media. This ploy was based on a human desire to be liked by others. And since everyone wants to be liked, people would be brainwashed into thinking that they should behave just like the people they admired. As Kirk and Madsen put it, it makes no difference that the ads are lies, not to us, because we're using them to ethically good effect, to counter negative stereotypes that are every bit as much lies and far more wicked ones. And so one begins to wonder how the media could be used in such a blatantly propagandistic way. The answer? Become the media. And this was another step in their plan. And thus, in 1990, we saw the launch of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association, also known as the NLJGA. In order to use the media, they simply infiltrated its ranks and they put themselves on the front line for attack. In just 10 years after its launch, in the year 2000, the NLJGA had a meeting in San Francisco where nearly every major news and media organization was represented. The discussion for center stage at this conference was whether or not, when reporting on stories related to homosexuality, do journalists have to include any viewpoints that contradict those of homosexuals? Can you believe it? Basically, what they are saying is, Do we have to report the truth? MSNBC producer Raymond Escobar compared the opinion of homophobes to those of the Ku Klux Klan, and virtually all of them agreed that getting another opinion is absurd and inane. And thus, the jamming and cramming had become even more aggressive and effective. In order to stamp out any opposition, simply make it seem as though there is none. Recently, we've seen another marketing scheme in the same-sex marriage issue. Homosexuals would like us to believe that they are good people and they only have one sexual partner with which they want to spend the rest of their lives. This, despite a study by Alan Bell, which revealed that 43% of gays had more than 500 sexual partners. They would have us believe that theirs is true love and they simply want to be viewed as wholesome, loving people when the facts reveal otherwise. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians in chapter 15. Now, the reason I've mentioned some of these tactics is because I believe there are Christians who have been influenced by them. Perhaps in some small way, perhaps in a larger way. It might not be to the point where we would condone homosexuality, but we might empathize with them and excuse away their behavior. Perhaps some of us have believed another aspect of the marketing lie, that people have no choice and were in fact born homosexual. This is another lie. Don't believe it for a second. Kirk and Madsen even admit this fact while they explain this. And they say, for all practical purposes, gays should be considered born gay. To suggest that it might be choice is to open a can of worms labeled moral choices. Straights must be taught that it is as natural to be born homosexual as it is to be heterosexual. Brethren, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33. Be not deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners. Awake to righteousness and sin not, for some have not the knowledge of God. We cannot allow such deceit to sway us. Homosexuals were not born homosexual. Do not fall into this trap and believe these lies even for a moment. Playing along corrupts thoughts, which can corrupt good habits. And we have the knowledge of God. We should know better. These people do not have holy insight, and they lie through their teeth, even when they do know better. They would liken their cause to that of the blacks in the 50s and the early 60s, but they have forgotten one important thing, the truth. Their cause is not about rights. It's about redefining what is good and what is evil. Consider that everyone has a conscience, and when we violate that conscience with a desire to take pleasure in our violation, we will try to silence the inner voice within us. If that voice extends to those around us, we will try to silence them by turning them off and tuning them out. And this is what the homosexual movement has strived to do, and they have been very successful. Today, it has come to government programs and public schools that teach young children that having two daddies or two mommies is just as good as having a mother and a father. Why? Fairly recently, there was even one high school where they elected a cross-dressing boy as the homecoming queen. We know better, brethren. We cannot deny the fact that homosexuality is unnatural, period. The Bible and any good sense of what is right tells us this truth. Homosexuality is destructive. It is evil, just as God's people have always understood it to be. Let's turn over to Joshua in chapter 24. Another lie that has been sold to the American people is the myth of a separation between church and state. Despite the fact that the words separation, church, or state are nowhere to be found in the First Amendment, people have been cleverly sold a lie packaged and shipped out as the truth. Now, there are hundreds of documents and additional multitudes of historical facts showing that the fear of God was to always be a key factor in our government's workings. In times past, states had actually financially supported churches. In 1777, the government purchased 20,000 Bibles to hand out to the early forming states. Some states even required those seeking office to be Christians. The Continental Congress in the past had routinely designated days of fasting and prayer. State of the Union addresses, speeches, and letters of this country's founding fathers contain numerous references to God and country, even instructing our people to pay homage to and to worship God. And yet, deviants want to deny this truth. In so doing, they deny the very thing that made this country great. Today, there are quote-unquote history books where the homage paid to God in America's past has been edited out. Why, at home, my family has a number of old Looney Tunes on DVDs. They're quite entertaining. But at the beginning of these, there's a presenter that comments that some of these cartoons can contain a minute reference to prejudices that existed at the time of their creation. But to edit them out would be acting as though these prejudices did not exist, and so the cartoons were left intact. Now, we will not deny our past when it comes to something we did that was wrong, but we will deny what we did was right when it has to do with the moral God of the Bible. And so reprobate minds have falsely led this country to believe that a separation between God and country has always existed, despite the fact that our documented history proves that a partition between the God of the Bible and the government was never, ever the intent of the authors of the Constitution. I liken this to the situation of Joshua when he was in his final days of life. He understood that his mortal time on earth was coming to an end, and he wanted to make sure that the people would continue to follow the God who had blessed Israel. They would adhere to the law and the principles given to them by the God of Israel. And so, he called the elders and the judges of all the tribes for a final meeting, and he related to them these truths, and he gave them a brief history lesson of how and why they came to be, and the method by which they would continue to prosper. In Joshua in chapter 24, and beginning in verse 26, "Then Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up there under the yoke that was by the sanctuary of the Eternal. And Joshua said to all the people, 'Behold, this stone shall be a witness to us, for it has heard all the words of the Eternal which he spoke to us. It shall therefore be a witness to you, lest you deny your God.'" This country has also been given a stone of sorts, a history book to remind us of our roots, where we came from, and how we had become great. These are found both in the Bible and in the documents of early America. However, like Israel, over time, we have denied our history and have strayed further and further from the God who previously blessed the people in this land. And thus, we have now outlawed prayer in public schools. We have thrown books that pay regards to God out of our schools, out of the libraries, and replaced them with literature on sorcery, diversity, and homosexual acceptance. In our courts, we mock God. In one such case, a criminal who clubbed a 70-year-old woman to death and stole her Social Security check had his sentence overturned. Why? Because the prosecuting attorney mentioned a Bible verse in his closing statement, and the court could not accept anything that might influence the jury's opinion that was based on the moral principles of the Bible. Why, there's even another court case that is being urged by the government to overturn a murderer's sentence because the jurors consulted a Bible during deliberation. And a government official called the act of seeking guidance in the scriptures, and I quote, deeply, deeply troubling. In another incident, not that the Church of God would endorse the use of a cross, but just as an example of how far we have gone, there was a federal court that ruled a public cemetery could not have a planter in the shape of a cross since, and I quote, the mere sight of it could cause emotional distress to a passerby. And yet we allow a large Islamic supremacy group who is known by the FBI to be linked to terrorists to hold a jihadist recruiting conference in downtown Chicago. Well, I think that would fall into the category of emotional distress to all those people who lost loved ones during the attack of 9/11, wouldn't you? What has happened to the change, the reality, indeed the sanity of government officials and even our nation? To try and understand where we've lost our marbles, let's take a look at what the Constitution does say in its Bill of Rights. The First Amendment states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Let's read that again. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Let's see, does this say that Congress shall pay no respect to God? No. Does it say that it shall keep God out of Congress? No, although if God were here, he certainly would have no part of its corrupt dealings today. Does it say that we shall separate respect for God from its inner workings? No God in government? No. It simply says that Congress will make no law respecting or preferring one denomination over another. Now, we all know what this means, and for 150 years, the courts rightly interpreted and defended the First Amendment. Then, in 1947, things began to change. And it started with a Supreme Court case in which Justice Hugo Black said this, the First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. This false misrepresentation of the First Amendment took hold. And since that time, the court's rulings have progressively worked towards removing any vestige of God and Christianity from public property. Like the nation of Israel had succumbed to the surrounding heathen people and allowed their ways to influence how they kept the law of God until they finally rejected God, so has been the path of America. And this continues today. We have allowed the values of immoral heathens to change what made this country great. We are not only disregarding the morality of the Bible, we are altering the Constitution written by this country's founding fathers, which was based upon virtue and the God of the Bible. And this is the real story behind the lie of a separation of church and state. And the courts, they even admit it. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg stated this about her and her fellow justices, and I quote, "Our island or Lone Ranger mentality is beginning to change. We are becoming more open to comparative international law perspectives." In another statement, Justice Stephen Breyer said this on ABC News, "We see all the time how the world is really growing together. It's becoming more and more one world of many different kinds of people. And whether our Constitution and how it fits into the governing documents of other nations, I think will be a challenge for the next generations. Whether our Constitution will fit into the documents of other nations. And this is the truth behind the alteration of the meaning of things like the First Amendment. just as false Christians twist and reinterpret the scriptures to mean what they want them to mean, so are professing Americans in our government. They are twisting the meaning of the Constitution to fit into what they believe the world is turning towards. And what is it turning towards? Godless immorality. The point is this. There are corrupt minds with hidden and not so hidden agendas in places of power. They are using a sleight of hand to make us think that the Constitution says something that it in fact does not. Now, there may be some fine judges in our so-called justice system that are not influenced in this way, but far too many of them don't see themselves as guardians of a virtuous contract between the people of this country and the government that they elected. Instead, as David Capellian put it, they see themselves as high priests of a new order chosen to chart the path in a more enlightened world. Sadly, America's light in this world is fading as we fall further into sinful darkness. Let's turn over to Proverbs in chapter 3. The media and government officials seem to be working alongside Satan, using wiles of the devil to make something that is wrong sound like it's right. However, it is a lie, and it is verbal seduction. It might sound good and even logical at times, and they have swayed the opinion of millions, but as we can see, they are adding words to documents that are not there, nor were they intended to be. Now, there's a proverb whose principle is again being rejected by these men, just as the God who inspired them is also being abandoned. Proverbs 30, and in verse 5, it states, "Every word of God is pure. He is a shield unto them that put their trust in him. Add thou not unto his words, lest he reprove thee, and you be found a liar." Now, I am in no way insinuating that the Constitution is a sacred document inspired by God. However, it's clear that those who wrote it, they deeply respected God. They deeply revered the morals of the Bible. People who have corrupted the meaning of that document are liars and have added to it that which was not meant to be. Let's turn over to Ephesians in chapter 6 for a final scripture. Now, I point these things out today because we as God's people have to be aware of the tactics being used by Satan and his instruments. And yes, these people are his instruments, and they have cleverly taken moral and ethical principles and turned them into a license to sin. As Paul wrote to Timothy, "Evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." And Satan has deceived them. They are deceiving others, and their seduction can play on us if we are not aware of what is happening. Those who are dancing to the tune of trickery are deceived. And like the Pied Piper in the fairy tale, the music played by Satan's instruments is appealing and persuades people to follow a path of iniquity. The words of his proponents may sound sweet and soothing, but if we look closely, we can see the strings behind the curtain. It is our job, it is our duty to be aware of these devices so that we will not fall prey to the con. As Paul instructed, continue in the things which we have learned and have been assured of. This we are to be doing, being grounded in the word of truth. In Ephesians 6 and verse 10, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." And so next time, in part 2 of this sermon, We'll go over some of the other schemes of Satan that have brought about the extreme degradation of quality and character in this country and have also influenced some Christians in the very Church of God.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you'd like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we'd like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at www.eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.